program. Hmm. He fiddles around some more. I don't see your network. Maybe we have to reboot the router. I shake my head. There's no router, Scotty. No internet. He looks at me, then looks around like he's remembering who I am, who Trisha is. Oh, that's okay. We can play something on your computer. He pulls the laptop back toward him. What games do you have? I don't know. It depends if Meg had any games. Scotty and I look at each other and almost smile. Meg hated video games, thought they sucked out valuable brain cells. And sure enough, there's nothing on the computer except what came preloaded. We can play solitaire, I say. You can't play solitaire with two people, Scotty says. That's why it's called solitaire. I feel like I've let him down. I start to close the computer, but then Scotty holds it open. Is that what she sent the note from? Scotty is 10. I am pretty sure it's not healthy for him to be talking about stuff like this. Not with me. I close the computer.
Cody, nobody tells me anything.
His voice is so plaintive. I remember the goodbye she sent him. Also from this computer. Yes. This is the computer she sent the note from.
Can I see it?
Scotty.
I know everyone wants to protect my innocence and stuff, but my sister swallowed poison. It's kinda too late.
I sigh. I have a printout of her suicide note in the box under my bed, but I know that's not what he wants to see. I know he's seen the note or read it or heard about it, but he wants to see its origin. I open up the sent mail file. I show him the note. With squinting eyes, he reads it.
Did you ever think it was weird that she said that the decision was my own to make?
I shake my head. I hadn't.
It's just when we used to get busted for doing something together and she wanted to keep me out of trouble, that's what she'd tell Mom and Dad. Scotty had nothing to do with it. It was my own decision. It was how she'd protect me.
I remember all the times Meg dragged Scotty into one of her schemes and then had to extricate him. She was always taking the fall for him. Most of the time, deservedly so. I still don't quite get what he's saying. So the 10-year-old has to spell it out for me.
It's almost like she's protecting someone.
Chapter 12. After Scotty leaves, I go through Meg's emails yet again. There's all that deleted sent mail, which I haven't been able to understand. Why would she delete only the sent messages, but not the inbox? Or did she delete mail from her inbox too, only I don't know what to look for? Why those 6 weeks? And what else did she delete? Is there a way to find the old messages? Are they gone for good? I have no idea. I don't know anyone who would know this. But then I remember Harry Kang, Meg's roommate who studies computers. I fumble for the scrap of paper Alice wrote her cell phone on and I call it. She's not there, so I leave a message asking her to have Harry call me. The next morning at 7:45, my phone rings, waking me up.
Hello?
My voice is groggy. This is Harry Kang, he says. I sit up in my bed.
Oh, Harry, hi, it's Cody.
I know, I called you.
Right, thank you. Look, I don't know if you can help me with this, but I have a computer and I'm trying to find deleted emails.
You're calling me because your computer crashed?
It's not my computer. It's Meg's. And I'm trying to recover files that I think she tried to delete.
He pauses now as if considering.
What kind of files?
I explained to him about all the missing sent messages and how I'm trying to recover them, and recover any other messages that might have been deleted.
It may be possible to do that using a data recovery program. But if Meg wanted those files deleted, maybe we should respect her privacy.
I know. But there was something in her suicide note that makes me think that she might not have acted alone.
And then there's a bunch of missing emails. It doesn't feel right.
The line goes quiet for a minute.
You mean someone might have coerced her?
Can you coerce someone to drink poison?
I don't know what I mean. That's why I want to find those emails. I wonder if they're in this folder I found in her trash. It won't open.
What happens when you try?
Hang on. I turn on the laptop and drag the file from the trash. I open it and get the encryption message. I tell Harry.
Try this.
He feeds me a bunch of complicated keystrokes. Nothing works. The file remains encrypted. He gives me another set of commands to try, but still they don't work.
It seems like a pretty sophisticated encryption, Harry says. Whoever wrote it knew what they were doing.
So it's locked for good?
Harry laughs. No, nothing ever is. If I had the computer, I could probably decrypt it for you. You can send it down if you want, but you'll have to hurry because school ends in 2 weeks.
I take the computer to the drugstore, which has a shipping outlet at the back. Troy Boggins, who was a year ahead of me in high school, is working behind the counter.
Hey, Cody. Where you been hiding?
He asks. I haven't been hiding, I say. I've been working.
Oh, yeah, he drawls. Where are you working these days?
There's nothing to be ashamed of about cleaning houses. It's honest work, and I make good money. Probably more than Troy. But Troy didn't spend 4 years of high school going on about how the minute the ink was dry on his diploma, he was getting the hell out of here.
Well, I didn't either.
Meg did. Though, like most of her plans, it became my plan, too. Then Meg left and I stayed. When I don't answer, Troy tells me it'll cost $40 each way to mail the computer.
Plus more if you want insurance.
$80? That's how much a bus ticket costs. The weekend's coming up, and I have cash from the extra shifts. I decide to take the computer to Tacoma myself. I'll get the answers faster that way. I tell Troy I changed my mind.
No worries,
he says. I turn to walk away. As I do, Troy says,
"Wanna hang out sometime? Go out for a beer?"
Troy Boggins is the kind of guy that, if you added 15 or 20 years, Trisha would date. He never paid me any attention in high school. His sudden interest should be flattering, but instead it feels ominous. Like without Meg by my side, it's clear what I am, what I've been all along. When I tell Trisha I'm going back to Tacoma for the weekend, she gives me a funny look. It's not like she'll stop me. I'm 18. And even if I weren't, she's never been that kind of mother.
Is there a guy?
She asks. What? No. It's for Meg's stuff. Why would you say that? She narrows her eyes and sniffs, like she's trying to smell something on me. Then she gives me $20 for the trip. I text Alice that I'm coming and ask if I can crash, and she responds with a bunch of exclamation points, like we're buddies or something. She says she'll be gone most of Saturday at her internship, but we can hang out Sunday. I tell Harry I'm coming too, and he says he'll look at the computer right away, that he's looking forward to it. I get in late, but the couch has been made up for me. I crash there. In the morning, Harry and I go into his room, which has like 5 computers in it, all on and humming. We turn on Meg's. He opens her mail program first.
I'm not sure about retrieving the deleted email, he says once he's looked around. Her mail program is set to use IMAP, so once messages are deleted here, they're also gone from the server.
I nod, as if that makes sense to me. He clicks on the encrypted file.
She probably meant to throw this away, too, but the encryption got corrupted somehow, and it prevented the machine from throwing it away.
What do you mean?
You found it in the trash, right?
I nod again.
She probably tried to empty it. But watch.
He goes to the menu and selects empty trash.
Don't!
I yell. He holds up his hand for me to stop. Some of the things empty. But then an error message reads, the operation cannot be completed because the item unnamed folder is in use.
I put some dummy folders in the trash so we could see that it'll empty that, but not this. And don't worry, I already copied this folder onto my computer. But my guess is, she meant to toss it, but couldn't.
Oh.
Whatever it is, it's something she didn't want people to see. You sure you want to see it?
I shake my head. I'm not sure at all. This isn't about what I want.
Okay. I'm doing something this afternoon, but I'll work on it before and when I get home. It's going to take a little bit of doing.
I'm about to apologize, but I see the delight in Harry's eyes. Like I've just given him the world's biggest puzzle. So I thank him instead.
He nods. How are the cats doing?
Don't know. That guy Ben took them.
He lives in Seattle, right?
I shrug. I think that's what he said.
If you want to check on the cats, my church group is going up there this afternoon to paint a youth center. We could give you a ride.
They're kittens, Harry, not babies. And they're probably not even there. He was sending them to his mom. Though the way Ben talked, I didn't get the sense he was the kind of guy who saw his mom every week. Anyhow, they're not my concern anymore.
He holds his hands up. Sorry. You seem pretty into them. Meg was.
I'm not Meg.
He nods again. Let me get to work on this.
The morning drags on. Alice and Stoner Richard aren't home and Harry hasn't left his room. So I sit there on the front porch, watching the rain come down. In the corner, I see one of the catnip-filled mice the kittens would spend hours attacking. It's like it's staring at me. Oh, fine. I grab my phone and text Ben. How are the cats? He texts back immediately.
Out back, trying to catch rain.
Then he texts a picture of them frolicking in a yard. Good pastime for Seattle cats.
Beats chasing tail.
You'd know.
Huh. Where are you?
Tacoma. There's a lag before the next text. Then,
come visit them? They grow up so fast.
I'm not entirely sure why my stomach does a little tumble, except that the thought of seeing Ben McAllister is both repulsive and the opposite of that. Before I've had a chance to think too much about it, I text back, okay. 3 seconds later,
need a lift?
I'm covered. He sends me his address and tells me to text him when I'm on the road. There's a whole vanload from Harry's church group going to Seattle, and I'm a little shocked to find Stoner Richard crammed into the back.
Hey, Cody,
he says. Hey, Richard, I reply. Didn't take you for
a Christian?
He laughs.
I'm just in it for the paint fumes. I'm all out of weed.
One of the girls in the middle seat throws a paint roller at him. Shut up, Richard. You are so full of shit. Cursing Stoner, do-gooding Christians.
Okay.
She turns to me. His father is a minister in Boise. Do you go to church? Only because memorial services are so often held in them. She and Richard and Harry exchange a look, and even though I don't think she goes to Cascades, it's clear she knows what and who I'm talking about. Someone blasts Sufjan Stevens, and Richard and Harry and the rest of the van sing along, all the way to the outskirts of Seattle. I text Ben that I'm nearby.
Repeat just hit the litter box. He texts back. I'll save it for you.
I allow a smile at that.
Careful.
This from Stoner Richard. We're pulling onto the off-ramp now, and he is climbing over the back row. You're the one surfing in a moving vehicle. He squeezes next to me.
I know how guys like that are. Saw how he was with Meg. Charming on the outside, but inside, total douche.
And here's the crazy, awful, horrible thing. For 1 second, I almost defend Ben. But then I catch myself and I'm appalled, because Richard is right. Ben is a dick. He slept with Meg and then he blew her off. And now that she's dead, he feels bad about it, and he's trying to be nice to me to make up for it.
I'm not sure why I'm here, why I'm in Tacoma picking at scabs that need to scar, or why I'm in Seattle being dropped off in front of a shabby craftsman bungalow in Lower Queen Anne. But it's like I'm being pushed along by a momentum stronger than me, because before I have a chance to change my mind, to tell the do-gooders that I'll come with them for the afternoon and paint, Harry is telling me they'll be back around 5, and Richard is eyeing me with an expression that I can only describe as paternal, though I'm the last person in the world who would know what that actually looks like. And the van is roaring off. I stand in front of the fading blue house, beer cans and cigarette butts out front. I try to summon some of that anger, that hatred for Ben, to somehow propel me inside. The door cracks open and out comes a little gray blur. I watch it go by. Pete, Ben was right. He's gotten bigger. Then the door swings wider and Ben runs after him in bare feet, his hair wet.
Shit!
What?
We don't let them out in the front.
He dives under a bush and comes back holding Pete by the scruff of his neck.
Too much traffic.
Oh. Ben holds out the now-compliant kitten for me to take. So I kiss him on his fuzzy head and he proceeds to claw me right under my ear.
Ouch!
I yell.
It gets a little rambunctious.
I can see that. I hand him back to Ben.
Let's go inside, he says.
He opens the door to the house. The hardwood floors are scuffed, but there are nice new built-in wooden shelves everywhere, full of books, record albums, and flickering novena candles. Ben turns on a light and leans in, and for a second I think he's going to kiss me or something, and my fists tighten. But he pulls back my hair and peers at my neck.
That's pretty nasty, he says.
I touch my finger to the scratch, which is starting to rise into a welt.
It's okay. You should rinse it with hydrogen peroxide.
I'm fine. He shakes his head.
The cats use the litter box. You could get cat scratch fever.
That's not a real thing. It's just a song.
It is too a real thing. Your glands swell up.
How do you know so much about cats?
We had a bunch of them growing up. My mom didn't believe in spaying or neutering, for pets or humans.
I follow him into a pink 1960s bathroom, humid from his recent shower. He digs around in the medicine cabinet and pulls out a bottle of hydrogen peroxide. He dabs some on a tissue and leans over toward me. I grab the tissue. I can manage, I say. The scratch goes white and foamy and stings for a second, and then it's fine. And then we're just standing there in the bathroom, all warm and wet and small. I walk out and Ben follows, giving me the tour. The mismatched furniture in the living room, the menagerie of musical equipment in the basement. He shows me his room, a dark futon and dark walls and an acoustic guitar in the corner, and the same nice shelving as in the living room. I don't go beyond the doorway. The rain has stopped. So he leads me down a long staircase that slopes into the backyard. He gestures around.
This is where they spend most of their time.
Who? And then I remember why I'm here. Oh, the boys.
Actually, about that, he begins.
You had them snipped?
Meg already did.
He stumbles over her name, but then writes himself.
But they're not boys. Not both of them. Repeat's a girl. I figured they were brothers.
They must be littermates. And anyhow, it still works.
What still works?
The joke. Ben looks at me perplexed, so I explain. Pete and Repeat went out in a boat. Pete fell out. Who was saved? He stops himself.
Oh, I get it.
He scratches his head and thinks for a second.
Except she named them wrong, because it's not the girl who saved.
And there we are. Back to the real reason I'm here. Not to see the kittens, but because of this. Because in some awful way, this binds us now.
We stand there in the soggy afternoon. Then he sits down on the steps, lights up a cigarette. He offers me one. I shake my head. "Don't drink, don't smoke," I say, mimicking the 80s song Meg and I discovered on one of Sue's old mixtapes. "What do you do?" Ben asks, completing the lyric. I sit down next to him. "Yeah, that's a good question." I turn to him. "What do you do?"
"I do odd construction jobs, woodworking. I play some shows."
"Right, the Scarps."
"Yep, we had a show last night. And another tonight."
"Double header."
"You could stay. Catch the show tonight. It's in Belltown."
"I'm staying in Tacoma."
"I could give you a ride back. Probably not tonight, but tomorrow. You could crash here."
"Is he for real?"
I give him a disgusted look, and he sort of shrugs. "Or not." He sucks on his cigarette. "What are you doing here anyway?"
"Visiting the cats," I say, defensive. "You invited me, remember?"
After I texted him.
Why the hell did I text him?
"No, I mean on the coast. In Tacoma."
I explained to him about Meg's computer, the deleted files, the encrypted folder, Harry's computer wizardry. A weird expression crosses his face.
"I don't think it's a good idea to read her emails."
"Why? You got something to hide?"
"Even if I did, you already went and read my emails."
"Yeah. That's what got me started on this." He twirls the cigarette between his fingers.
"But those emails were mine, written to me. It was my right to show you those. I don't think you should dig into private things like that."
"When you die, you're not a person anymore, and privacy kind of becomes a moot point." Ben looks uncomfortable.
"What are you looking for, exactly?"
I shake my head. "I'm not sure. But something is suspicious."
"Suspicious how? Like, she was, what, murdered?"
"I don't know what I think, but something's weird about it. Something's fishy. Starting with the fact that Meg wasn't suicidal. I've been thinking about this. Even if I didn't know what was going on when she moved here, I've known her all her life, and not in all those years did she ever think about this or talk about it. So something else happened, something to push her over the edge."
"Something to push her over the edge,"
Ben repeats. He shakes his head and lights a fresh cigarette with the butt of his last one.
"What exactly?"
"I'm not sure, but there was this line in her suicide note about the decision being hers alone to make. Like, who else's would it be?" Ben looks tired. He's quiet for a long time.
"Maybe she wrote that to exonerate you."
I hold his gaze for a moment longer than is comfortable. "Well, she didn't." It starts to rain again, so Ben and I go back inside. He makes us burritos with some black bean and tempeh mixture that's in the fridge, and then shows me where he keeps a secret stash of cheese in a Tupperware container and grates it on top. By the time we finish eating, we've spent all of 1 hour together, and the guys won't be back until 5. And the time stretches ahead of us like a yawn. Ben offers to take me around Seattle to see the Space Needle or something, but it's unseasonably cold out, and I don't feel like going anywhere.
"What do you want to do?"
he asks. There's a small TV in the living room. Suddenly, the idea of doing something normal, no memorial services, no computer sleuthing, but just hanging out all afternoon in front of the TV, the kind of thing that hasn't felt right to do since Meg, is so appealing. "We could watch TV," I suggest. Ben looks surprised, but then he grabs the remote and clicks on the set and hands me the changer. We watch a rerun of The Daily Show while the cats snuggle up next to us. Ben's phone keeps vibrating with texts, chiming with calls. When he goes into the other room to take a couple of the calls, I can hear the low murmur of his side of the conversation. something came up. Maybe we can hang tomorrow night, he tells one caller. I overhear a squirmingly long conversation in which he repeatedly explains to some clearly dense girl named Bethany why he can't visit her. He keeps telling her that maybe she can come up to see him. Seriously, Bethany, get a clue. Even I can hear his lack of conviction. When he comes back to the sofa, I flip to MTV, which is having a marathon of 16 and Pregnant. Ben's never seen it before, so I explain the premise to him. He shakes his head. That's a little too close to home. Yeah, I'll bet, I say. His phone chirps with another text. If you'd like some privacy, I can leave, I offer. I would like some privacy, actually, Ben says, and I'm about to gather my shit, wait out the next few hours in a cafe, when he turns off his phone. We watch the show. After a few episodes, Ben gets into it, yelling at the TV like Meg and I used to. Good argument for mandatory birth control, he says. Have you ever gotten a girl pregnant? I ask. Ben's eyes go wide. They're an electric shade of blue now. Or maybe it's just the reflected glow of the TV. That's a personal question. I kind of think we're beyond standing on ceremony, don't you? He looks at me. There was a scare once in high school, but it was a false alarm. Since then, I learned my lesson. I always use condoms, unlike these assholes. He points to the TV. Sometimes I think I should go ahead and get snipped, like Pete and Repeat. Like Pete. Repeat's a girl, so she got her ovaries out or something. Okay, like Pete. Don't you want kids? One day? I know I'm supposed to, but when I picture my future, I don't see it. Live fast, die young. Everyone romanticizes that notion, and I hate it. I saw a picture of Meg's body from the police report. There is absolutely nothing romantic about dying young. No. It's not like I see myself dead or anything. It's just I don't see myself connected. I don't know about that, I say. You seem pretty connected. I gesture to his cell phone. I guess. You guess? Let me guess. Did you have a girl over last night? His ears go a little pink, which answers the question. And will you have a girl over tonight? That depends, he begins. On what? If you decide to stay over. What the hell, Ben? Are you like some kind of addict? Can you not help yourself? He holds up his hands in surrender. Chill, Cody. I meant if you crashed on the couch or something, you'd stay over. Ben, I will clarify this for you so there are no misunderstandings. I will never sleep with you, or in the vicinity of you. I'll cross you off the list. A long list, I imagine. He has the good grace to look embarrassed by this. We watch the TV for a while longer. Can I ask you something else? If I say no, will that stop you? He answers. Why do you do this? I mean, I get why guys want to have sex. I get that guys are all horny all the time. But why a different girl every night? It's not a different girl every night. Near enough, I'm guessing. Ben pulls out a pack of cigarettes, toys with an unlit one. I can see he wants to light up, but I don't think smoking's allowed in the house. After a while, he puts the cigarette back in the pack. You know what you know, he says. What's that mean? It's just becoming a man. It's not like it's something that happens instinctively. He trails off. Oh, please. I've never met my father, and my mother is hardly a role model. And I don't blame my shit on them. So what's your story? You didn't have a father, Ben? Cry me a river. He looks at me, his face gone hard. The Ben from the stage. The Ben from Meg's room that first time. Oh, I had a father, he says. Who do you think I learned it from?
At 4:30, Harry texts that they're wrapping up and should be there soon. I start to gather my stuff, and Ben and I go wait out front.
"Am I going to see you again?"
he asks. My breath catches. I'm not sure why.
"Because if I'm not," he continues, "there's something I need to tell you."
"Oh, okay." So this is why he wanted me to come up. Not to see the kittens, but to take his confession.
"Go ahead, then."
He takes a long drag on his cigarette, and when he exhales, there's not nearly enough smoke. It's like all that toxic stuff stayed in him.
"She cried. After we slept together, she cried. She'd been okay. And then she was crying."
"Was she drunk?" I ask. "Like, really drunk?"
"You mean, did I fuck her when she was passed out? Jesus, Cody. I'm not that big of a shitbag."
"You'd be surprised how many people are." And I tell him about Meg's other first time. That party, sophomore year. She'd done a bunch of Jägermeister shots and had been making out with Clint Randhurst. Things went too far, too fast. And though she didn't exactly say no, she definitely hadn't said yes. To make matters even worse, Clint must have been the one to give her mono, because after that was when she got sick. After Clint, Meg swore that she was never going to do that again, unless it was with someone she truly cared about. Which is how I know she cared about Ben, even if maybe she shouldn't have. "So it wasn't you. You weren't the reason she cried. Or if she did, it was happiness or relief, maybe. She clearly liked you. Maybe that's why she cried." I tell him this to unburden him, or maybe to unburden me. At Meg's insistence, I never told anyone about Clint. But if anything, Ben looks more cut up. He shakes his head, looks down, and doesn't say anything. When the do-gooder van pulls up, Stoner Richard sees Ben's downcast eyes and looks at me.
"What'd he do now?"
Richard asks. "Nothing." I climb in the van.
"If you find anything else on her computer, will you tell me?" Ben asks.
"Okay." He closes the door behind me and knocks on it 2 times. And then we drive away. Chapter 13. Harry works on the computer all night, and then the next morning. When I wake up early, his light is on, and I'm not entirely sure he's been to sleep.
"I've almost got it," he says, eyes gleaming with excitement. "This was such an unusual encoding. Did Meg do it herself?"
I shake my head, shrug.
"If she did, then I mourn her loss even more."
Now he shakes his head.
"We could have had so much fun geeking out together."
I smile politely.
"You never know people, do you?"
he asks. "No, you don't." Alice wakes up a few hours later and tackles me in a hug like we are best friends. "Where were you yesterday?" she asks. "No one was here. I went to Seattle with the guys." "I waited for you, and then you didn't come back, so I went to the movies." "Never mind. You're here now. I'm going to make us French toast," she declares, "with homemade bread." I follow her into the kitchen. She goes to slice the loaf of bread but can't get a knife through it. I suggest we go out instead. We go back to the diner I spent the night in a few weeks ago. Alice doesn't like it because the eggs aren't free range, but I like it because the breakfast special is $2.99. Alice gabs on about her term, her upcoming finals, summer back in Eugene, which she says, if the weather is nice, is like living in Eden, including the nakedness in some circles. She invites me to come down before she goes to Montana for her summer job. I put on a tight smile. I'm not sure what else to do, because she's acting like we're friends and we're not friends. We are mutual acquaintances.
Only the person we're mutually acquainted with is no longer.
Why'd you go to Seattle yesterday? She asks after a bit.
To see the kittens?
And Ben McAllister?
Yeah. He was there, too.
Her eyes flicker up. He's pretty hot, right?
I guess so.
You guess so? He and Meg had a thing, right?
I think of Ben's tawdry description of it. I fucked her. He'd said, so full of distaste for Meg, for the act, for himself. I wondered why he even bothered.
I wouldn't classify it as a thing. I wouldn't mind a piece of that thing.
Alice seems so sweet, so young, so innocent. What would happen to her after she'd been used and abused by Ben? It's not a pretty picture.
Yes, you would. When we're finishing up breakfast, Harry texts me. Cracked it. I pay for both breakfasts, and we hustle back to the house. Harry is waiting for us on the porch, Meg's computer in his lap. Look, he says. I look. There's a document open. It has a professional letterhead reading High Watt Industrial Cleaning Company and some numbers. What's that?
It's a business license.
Why would she have that on her computer?
You need a license to buy this.
He clicks over to another window. It has a list of lethal chemical agents, where to procure them, how to procure them, expected physical effect, and success rates. The poison Meg used is listed. It has one of the highest success rates. I start to feel sick to my stomach.
There's more, Harry says. He opens another document. This one, a sort of checklist, the kind of thing you'd get in a class. But when I peer closer, I see the items in the left-hand column are a sort of syllabus for death. Order poison. Pick day. Write note. Clear email / browser cache. Email note on time delay delivery.
Oh, God. I begin.
Cody, Harry says, with an edge of warning in his voice. There's more. He opens a simple text document. In an almost breezy tone, it congratulates whoever's reading this on making the brave and ultimate step toward self-determination. It goes on to say, we have no say in our births, and generally little say in our deaths. Suicide is the one exception. It takes a brave soul to choose this path. Suicide can be a sacred rite of passage. The note continues, listing sickening specific details on the best places and times to do it, how to conceal plans from loved ones. It even offers tips for what to write in the suicide note. Portions of the sample note are Meg's. Verbatim. I lean over the porch banister and throw up into the wild tangle of lavender hydrangea. Alice is crying, and Harry is looking mildly panicked, like he has no idea what to do with either of us.
Who would do such a thing? I gasp.
Harry shrugs. I did a little more digging, googling some of the advice from the notes, and it turns out there are a lot of suicide support groups.
Support groups?
Alice asks, confused. To encourage suicide, not prevent it, I say. Harry nods. They used to be more active online, but now there are only a few left. Which might explain all the cloak-and-dagger secrecy. This literature seems to come from one group in particular, the Final Solution. Nice name. He shakes his head in mild disgust. Whoever originated these files clearly didn't want to get found out. Harry smiles, then seems to remember he shouldn't. The irony is, if she'd kept the files unencrypted and thrown them away, they wouldn't be on her hard drive anymore.
How do you know for sure it's this Final Solution group? Alice asks.
Meg cleared her browser history, but didn't empty her cache.
He looks at me, then at the computer.
The Final Solution was in there.
Chapter 14. Trisha, the town crier, has alerted about half of Shitburg that I've gone to Tacoma again, which means that Joe and Sue have found out. Only I don't realize that until they call me up and invite me over for dinner. And when I get there, they blindside me with the simple question of why I went back. I left in a rush last time, and I wanted to make sure I didn't leave anything there. Oh, Cody, you didn't have to do that, Sue says. She shakes her head and dumps some boiled-in-a-bag pasta onto my plate. It looks like something Trisha would make. You're so good to us. My secret, Meg's secret, feels caustic. I hadn't intended for it to be a secret. The entire bus ride home, I'd debated whether or not to tell them. Would it make any difference? Would it bring them more grief? Never coming to a decision, but avoiding the Garcias when I got back. And then 3 days had gone by, and the decision seemed to have made itself. Sue clears the dishes. She eyes my plate, but doesn't mention how little I've eaten. I notice that she just pushed her food around, too. Will you stay? She asks. Joe finally went into her room. Meg's room, which, according to Scotty, no one had really gone into since her death. Scotty said he'd peeked in a few times because it looked the same as always, like Meg was about to come home. I could picture it so clearly. The messy desk full of wires and soldering guns. The corkboard with its collage of old record albums, charcoal drawings, and photos. The graffiti wall, as we called the one opposite the windows that had this ugly floral wallpaper. Until Meg got inspired and tore it down and sharpied all over the underlying plaster with favorite quotes and lyrics. Sue had been so mad about that. First because it was defacing property, and then because members of their church, who'd been over for a potluck, thought that some of Meg's writing was sacrilegious. "You know how people are, Joe," Meg had overheard Sue saying. But Joe had come to Meg's defense. Who cared about those gossips? If the wall was a good outlet for Meg, leave it be. They could paint over it when she moved out. They never did, though. Now I doubt they ever will. "We've found some of your things," Joe says, "and some things of Meg's you might like." "Another time," I say. "I have to be up early for work." "Is this how it is with lies? The first one comes hard. The second one easier, until they slip off your tongue easier than truths? Maybe because they are easier than truths." I let myself out. But before the door shuts behind me, Scotty is there, leashing Samson. "Walkies," he says to me. "I gotta hurry," I reply. "That's okay. Samson likes to run, don't you, boy?" I take off at a fast clip. And Scotty easily keeps up with me because he's 10, and he has legs up to his elbows. Samson bounds along, sniffing for things to pee on. When we're at the end of the block, he asks me why I went back to Tacoma. "I told you. I wanted to make sure I didn't leave anything there." I don't know if it's harder to lie to kids, or if they just have better bullshit detectors, but in either case, he gives me this cynical look that hurts my heart. "Why'd you really go?" he asks. "Scotty, can we not do this? Just tell me why you went. You found something, didn't you?" Scotty is tall and rangy and has Sue's blonde hair, though it's starting to darken. I know he thinks all his innocence has been destroyed, but he's only 10 years old. It hasn't. And if it has, he has time to get it back. But not if I tell him. How she posed as a buyer from a cleaning company to order what should have been a heavy-duty upholstery detergent. How she went through all this extra trouble because that was the Meg way, but also because she apparently was so hell-bent on dying, she needed the chemical with the smallest margin of error. How meticulously she plotted it in that Meg fashion, like this were another concert she was trying to score a backstage pass to. "First we'll try the publicists, and if that doesn't work, we can try the radio station, and failing that,
We can always ask some of our band contacts to put in a word for us, she'd say. Her plans worked. They always worked. Meg may not have sent Scotty the suicide letter, but she did send him an I love you farewell note. I think she wanted to leave him with that. If I tell Scotty what I found, I'll wreck that. Maybe wreck him too. And we've already lost one Garcia this year. I shake my head. Nothing to find, Scotty, except for lint on the carpet. And then I leave him there, on the corner, in the dark. Chapter 15. After I decided I wouldn't be going to UW, but would be staying at home and attending the local community college, Trisha demanded I get a job. The Dairy Queen was hiring, so I asked for an application. I handed it in to the manager, who turned out to be Tammy Hentoff. "You're friends with that Garcia girl?" she asked, squinting at my application. "Meg, yeah. She's my best friend," I said. "She's in college in Tacoma now on a full scholarship," I added. I was so proud of her. "Uh-huh." Tammy was not impressed. Or maybe she was just defensive. Since she'd run off with Matt Parner, people around here hadn't been all that nice to her. She'd lost her job at the car dealership where her husband had worked, and I'd heard that Matt's soon-to-be ex-wife Melissa and all her friends had taken to driving by the DQ and shouting nasty things. Not that Tammy didn't deserve it, but Matt still had his job at the Jiffy Lube, and no one drove by there yelling, "Whore." While Tammy was interviewing me, a bunch of high school students came by. The DQ had always been the local hangout. And it was then that I realized that if I got the job, I'd be serving burgers to people I'd spent the last 4 years not exactly snubbing, but sort of. Meg knew everyone here, and she had her admirers for sure. But she wasn't close with that many people. She had her family, the people she met online, and me. In middle school, teachers started calling us the pod, and it took. And then all sorts of people referred to us as that. We were known as a twosome. Even Tammy Hentoff, 7 years out of high school, knew about us. Working here, it would be a daily barrage. "Aren't you Meg's friend?" And the piggyback question to that, "If so, why are you still here?" Right about the same time, the night manager at the restaurant where Trisha works inquired if she knew anyone trustworthy who could clean her house. Trisha asked me, almost on a dare, it seemed. She knew how much I hated cleaning. "But you can be good at things you hate." Pretty soon that one job turned into two, and four, and now six. Just a couple of weeks ago, I got a call about a job as an attendant at Pioneer Park. Sue knew the woman who ran the parks department, and somehow, in the midst of everything, she put a word in for me and I got called in for an interview. It was a good job. Decent pay, benefits even. On the day of the interview with the superintendent, I walked to the park. And then I saw the rocket ship. Pioneer Park was where Meg and I learned to ride our bikes, where we'd run through the sprinklers and dreamed of the swimming pool the town sometimes talked about putting in there. It never happened. Nothing here ever does. It was a place that wasn't her house or my house or school or the DQ, where we could be alone and talk. The capsule at the top of the rocket ship was like our magical private clubhouse. Anytime we climbed the rickety stairs and ladder up to the nose cone, we were the only people there, though it was obvious from all the ever-changing graffiti that we weren't the only people to come up here. Reading the graffiti out loud was one of our favorite things to do. There were hearts of couples long since broken up, and lyrics nobody remembered anymore. New stuff was always being scrawled over the old, though one line, Meg's favorite, remained gouged into the metal. "I was here." She loved that. "What more can you say, right?" she'd asked. She'd written the phrase on her own graffiti wall, and kept threatening to get a tattoo of it one day, if she ever got over her fear of needles. The whole death trap probably should have been condemned years ago, but it wasn't. It was the highest point in town, and on clear days you could see for miles. Meg used to say you could see all the way to the future. I turned around. I never even called the superintendent to cancel. So I still clean houses. Maybe it's for the best. Toilets are anonymous. They have no stories to tell, no recriminations to fling. They just take crap and flush. Since coming back from this last trip to Tacoma, I actually find myself looking forward to work. The scrubbing, the endless repetition, the arriving at a manky sink, attacking it with bleach and steel wool, and after a time, leaving it gleaming. Befores slash afters in life are never quite so stark. Today I cleaned two houses in a row, hauling laundry and ironing pillowcases, and cleaning the squared kitchen tile with a squeegee. The tile isn't really tile, it's linoleum. But that's how Mrs. Chandler likes it done, and who am I to argue? Over the next few days, when I'm not working, I carry my cleaning zeal over to Trisha's and my tiny house, taking bleach and an old toothbrush and going at the shower grout, which has gone black with mildew. Trisha is so shocked when she sees the tiles go from gray to their previous white and blue state, she doesn't even say anything sarcastic. I keep myself busy in a frenzy until I don't have a gig, and our house is as clean as it's been since we moved in. I sit on my bed and organize my earnings by bill denominations. I've made $240 this week alone. I have to give Trisha $100 for my share of bills, but that leaves me with quite a surplus, and nothing to spend it on. Theoretically, I am saving for the move to Seattle. Theoretically, I learned in physics that the universe is expanding at a rate of, like, 45 miles a second. But it sure as shit doesn't feel that way when you're standing still. I shove the money into my metal box under the bed. Trisha has been known to pilfer cash if it's lying around. The house is quiet and stuffy, more claustrophobic than normal. I slide on my flip-flops and walk into town. Outside the Dairy Queen, I see a bunch of people I went to school with clustered on the benches under the cottonwood trees, including Troy Boggins. They wave and I wave back, but they don't invite me to sit down with them, and I don't pretend I want to. I go to the library instead. Now that Meg is gone and her house is no longer my second home, this is my sanctuary. Plus it has air conditioning. Mrs. Banks is sitting behind the reference desk, and when she sees me, she waves me over. "Cody, where have you been? I was about to send these back." She pulls out a rubber-banded stack of books, more of the Central Europeans, Karel Čapek's War with the Newts, Bohumil Hrabal's Too Loud a Solitude, a collection of Kafka short stories. "Thanks," I say. I am out of books, but as soon as I enter the cool of the library, I understand that's not why I'm here. I make my way to the computer terminals. I type "final solution" and "suicide" into the search box. It brings up mostly Hitler and neo-Nazi stuff, though there is one page that seems promising. But when I click on it, it won't load. I try the other sites from the search, and they won't either. "Is there something wrong with the computers?" I ask Mrs. Banks. "I don't think so. Why?" "I can't get pages to load." "Cody," she asks, "are you looking at naughty sites?" She's teasing, but I flush red anyway. "I'm doing a research project." "On what?" "Neo-Nazi groups?" Another lie. It just pops right out. "Ah, that'll do it. I can lift the filters for you if you like," she says. "No," I say quickly. "Nobody can know about this." And that's when I remember I have my own computer now. And the library has free Wi-Fi. "I mean, I have to leave now. But tomorrow?"
Anytime, Cody, she says. I trust you. The next day, I bring Meg's laptop to the library, and before I get started, Mrs. Banks shows me how to get around the filters. Then I get to work. The Final Solution website isn't so much a website as an entry portal. You have to click on a button claiming that you're over 18. When I do, I'm redirected to an index with different topic headings. I open a few messages. A lot of them are spam. A lot more are ranting. I scroll through a few pages and it seems like a waste of time. And then I see a subject heading, "What about my wife?" The post is from some guy who claims he wants to kill himself but wonders what it would be like for his wife, whom he loves. "Will it ruin her life?" he writes. There's a string of replies below. The majority opinion is that his wife will probably be relieved, that she's probably miserable too, and by offing himself, he'll put them both out of their misery.
"Women are way better at bouncing back from this kind of thing," one person writes. "She'll probably remarry within a few years and be much better off."
Who are these people? Is this who Meg was talking to? I read the responses again. So casual that you'd think they're offering advice on how to fix a broken carburetor. And as I do, my neck grows hot, and something turns in my stomach. I don't know if these people had anything to do with Meg. I don't know if this guy really intended to kill himself, or if he actually did. But I know one thing. You don't just bounce back. Chapter 16. After discovering the Final Solution boards, I spend every moment I can combing through the archives. Shitburg's not a very wired place, so basically all my research is done at the library, which, even with Meg's intervention, is only open limited hours, most of which overlap with my job. If we had an internet connection at home, I could get a lot more done. But when I raise the topic with Trisha, even offer to pay, she scoffs. "Why would we get that?" Once upon a time, I would have gone to the Garcias and used their computer, but I wouldn't feel comfortable doing that anymore, even if I weren't digging into Meg's suicide. So the library it is. "How are you liking the checks?" Mrs. Banks asks me one afternoon. I'm confused for a second, and then I remember the books I checked out. I haven't cracked a single spine. "They're interesting," I lie. Normally, I read two or three books a week and have very specific plot or character-related comments for her. "Would you like me to renew them for you?" "That would be great, thank you." I turn back to my computer. "Still working on that research project?" "Yeah," I say. "Anything I can help you with?" She leans in to look at the screen. "No," I say a little too loudly as I quickly minimize the window. Mrs. Banks looks taken aback. "Sorry, you've been so focused, I thought you might need help." "Thanks, I'm okay. I guess I'm not sure what I'm looking for." This part is true. Every day more posts are added. There are the ones asking for encouragement or advice on how to tie a noose, and the ones from people with terminally ill spouses or friends who want to help them die with dignity. And then there are the completely random rants about Israel or gas prices or who won Idol. There's a whole language that's used, shorthand for different methods, slang, like catching the bus, which is the way people here talk about offing themselves. Mrs. Banks nods knowingly. "I used to be a research librarian. When you're dealing with an unwieldy topic, the trick is to home in on a target. You have to aim for something specific rather than cast a wide net. So maybe an element of the neo-Nazi movement?" "Yeah, thanks." After she walks away, I ponder what she said. There is a function to search the archives. But when I use that to look for the kind of poison Meg took,
or the motel she went to, or university.